it's just dumb policy. It's very dumb policy while at the same time escalating with Iran, thinking that, you know, third time, fourth time, lucky. And the Iranians, like just now, I mean, just today, announced, okay, fine, no more traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, because that's our main leverage. And we're going to show to the world that we can do it. And the world, I mean, mainly we're going to show to the Americans. And we're going to put stress on the global fuel supply again and fertilizer supply and so on. Fine. Apparently, the Americans didn't understand that yet. However, all of this compounds now, which doesn't mean, though, that it makes it any easier on Russia. So the West is still banking on the fact that, you know, tomorrow the line is going to be so long, four, five, six cars at the pump, that the one in car number six is going to get out and walk to the Kremlin and take Putin and throw him right out, right? That's still the idea of what's going to happen. I mean, can you tell us how likely such a scenario is at the moment?
About as likely as me becoming the Pope.
Your Holiness.
And I'm not even Roman Catholic. I'm Orthodox, so the chances of that are even less.
But it's so dumb. It's so self-defeating. But still, that, I mean, I at this point, I have problems believing that they believe it themselves. But if they tell you time and
I think
time
they do.
At some point, you need to believe that that's what they believe.
And I want to touch on the destruction of the fueling stations in Ukraine, because there's a different reason for that. There's actually a different reason where it started. Anyways, the line, I can't say how the lines are outside of Moscow. When I leave in another week, I'll be able to see what they look like. I mean, I know what they looked like a week and a half ago. A week and a half ago, it was hit or miss. You know, in the cities, it wasn't bad. Some price gouging, but it wasn't bad. You know, in Voronezh, I just drove right in, fueled up, and Lugansk, I filled right up. Donetsk was bad, and I was warned, so I didn't fuel up. I used the canister. I just poured in from a canister. Rostov, it was a little harder, but that's because Rostov is, you know, all the traffic heading to the beaches and everything else goes to Rostov. So obviously a hell of a lot more cars right now filling up, not just the locals, but massive traffic coming in. On the interstates, it was hit or miss. Maybe like one in four, on the paid interstate, maybe one in four had fuel, because a lot of mom and pops, they can't buy because they buy from the big guys, and the big guys are feeding themselves right now. Plus, the further you're away from a major city, the longer it takes to get a truck out there, so the less often they get out there, because they've got plenty of demand inside the cities. So there's that. But I still filled up. On the way back, I decided I got off the paid interstate and went down to the feeder road, the feeder interstate, the free one. There's a lot more gas stations there. And you know, one petrol station, for example, this is, I think, a prime example, human nature too. I was down about a third of a tank. So I was like, yeah, I'll fill it up just in case. And I'm pulled up, drove by one station, had 20, 30 cars waiting. I'm like, I'm not that desperate. Drove 2 kilometers, and the next station's empty. There's like two cars.
Right.
So everybody piles up on that one, and nobody's looking at, you know, it's human nature. So it's hit or miss. But absolutely hit or miss.
Do you think it can create actual political trouble the way that it's going right now? On the other hand, you know, the government is actually admitting that there is a problem, and they are saying, like, we are working on fixing it. So they're not actually downplaying or, like, negating it. They're saying, like, we're working on fixing. What do you think the fix will be?
Well, the fix is going to be continue getting the stations back up, continue bringing in fuel out from India, from Russian oil, and continue as it is. Now there's machine gun trucks everywhere now, in the south, around these stations, around the petrol stations everywhere. They're popping up more and more often, and mass production of drone or anti-drone systems. Particularly in this case, there it's the Panther, the Panzer. It's got 4 missiles on each one and an autocannon. And you put multiple ones out there. I've seen them on outside of Moscow. You see them, because Moscow, except on key government buildings, you don't see anti-aircraft systems inside the city. They want to stop this outside the city. They don't want to use the Russian population as human shields, as opposed to the other side, which does that actively. You know, the day before the NATO summit started, Ukraine wanted to have another one of these big bangs on Moscow to have something to show for, especially since reality is they just lost Konstantinovka and basically have already lost Krasny Liman. So they launched 420 drones at Moscow. 36 of them got to Moscow Oblast. You should be able to appreciate it. Moscow Oblast is the size of Switzerland. That's one of the smallest provinces in Russia.
Right.
These old principality provinces, they're all relatively small compared to the further you go, the bigger they get. And those 36, none of them got to Moscow. So they were all shot down from multiple layers and guys on the Mad Max, technicals. And they said that. So, yes, that's the reaction. Machine guns are cheap, cheaper than drones. And they're reusable. The reason Russia started taking out the petrol stations in, first of all, in Kharkiv and Sumy, and now they're expanding, and they've destroyed all of them systematically, one by one. They just started working them over. Just in Sumy and Kharkiv, there were some like 600 stations that were destroyed. They're hitting them, and not to minimize human civilian casualties, but they're hitting them, and they're hitting them with Iskander missiles. So, there's no shooting them down because Ukraine doesn't have capacity to do that. Why they're doing it was Ukraine switched tactics. So the Ukrainians started using Gazelle trucks, which are these light cargo trucks. They're maybe like 5-tonners. And they have a big box. Well, depending on the model, these all had a big box in the back of them. And they were all carrying about 2 drones each, right? So first of all, they drive up to as close as they could to the line of contact, and they pop them off. Shoot and scoot. In this case, it's launch and scoot. So by the time they're out, that truck is hightailing it somewhere. And you use several hundred of these trucks. You launch hundreds of drones. The trucks are parked in garages or in underground parking, it's hard to find them. But their weak point was they're all refueling at these fuel stations.
Mm.
If you can't find the trucks, you can at least starve them. Additionally, depending on which drone they're launching, if they're short-range drones, they're charging up on a generator. And that's running off of diesel or gasoline. If they're not, you still have to fuel them up they're 2-banger moped engine running off of gasoline. So you have to have a lot of gasoline to launch them. And if there's no fueling stations, good luck launching.
Your interpretation is that Russia taking out the petrol stations in Ukraine is actually not so much about about slowing down the Ukrainian regular military forces, but to answer to these drone attacks, to make it harder for the drones to actually come close to the line of contact.
That was initially. Now what we're seeing is it's expanding. They're expanding it, and it should have been something that was done early on, at least with drones. But now that that's done, now they're moving into Kyiv. They're moving into western Donetsk, that's still under Ukrainian hands. And they're moving into Dnipropetrovsk and Zaporozhye City. And here's a kicker that's a game changer also in that we've got this last line of fortified cities. Now, let's repeat that. Last line. What does that mean? Behind those cities are open fields and small unfortified villages. There's no line of defense. What have we had before that? We've had this very thick agglomeration of towns and villages in what was central and eastern Donetsk Oblast and Lugansk Oblast, going down the Donbass, the base of the Don River, which is where you get all the huge amounts of iron and coal. So there's a lot of agglomerations just centered in that area. So every time Russia took a town or a city, what happened is Ukrainians moved back 10 kilometers into the next one, and the next one, and the next one, except there is no more next ones. This is it. So now, I mean, you had this in-depth defense, and you had in-depth logistics, so you could move things up because you had cover from city to city, urban area to urban area. There's nothing behind this. So anybody who wants to come in has to go across a very large area of open fields and wood lines and very small villages.
In Western newspapers, they are very, I mean, they're like filled ad nauseum now with this hint that, oh, by the way, open fields and so on are a big problem now for the Russians because the drones, Ukrainian drones, will take out all of these Russians. The Russians are dying like flies because of the drones that take them out. What about that?
The casualties have gotten worse because of drones. I mean, I'm not going to lie about it. In these areas, there is mass drones. These are the Quadro drones. But the Ukraine is still losing about 3 to 5 men for every Russian soldier. The majority of Russian casualties are from drones. The majority of Ukrainian casualties are from artillery. Drones are included in those, but artillery, because Russia always outnumbered the Ukrainians 7 to 10 to 1 on tubes. I'm not even talking about rocket artillery. And Russia could produce more rounds of ammunition than all of Europe by a factor of about 4. All of Europe plus America, all of NATO, basically, and Japan and South Korea combined by a factor of 4. And you know, as the church teaches, God sends you your enemies to get you to do the things he should have probably been doing anyways. So one of the things, that a nice little gift that that Russia got from the Americans is, okay, so do you know what gun cotton is? Okay, no, so you got gunpowder. Right, gunpowder has a certain amount of force behind it. Gunpowder is not normally used in artillery. Sometimes it's still used in bags of powder that are used behind an artillery shell. But for most part, what's used is called gun cotton. Gun cotton is very high quality cotton that's soaked in liquefied gunpowder. So it's impregnated with that gunpowder, and it gives you a lot more force for a bang for the buck as it disintegrates as it burns. Right. The problem, two problems. One, it's cotton, and two, it's high quality cotton, which is usually made for high quality clothing. So right off the bat, when the Europeans tried to expand, they had a problem because the majority of the high quality cotton was coming either from America, and America was using that for its own needs, or from China. And again, like everything, people just don't grow cotton for the hell of it. They grow it because they've got orders from the previous year to fill for the next growing season. You know, so right off the bat, those orders were already taken. So now you got to compete with the clothing industry. Two, China put restrictions on dual-use cotton for the Europeans. So the Europeans had very instantly very big problems trying to make gun cotton to fill the shells. Never mind, they also didn't have gas and steel. Yeah, it got to such a ridiculous point that in 24... the Industrial Union of Germany asked the German government to relieve the sanctions on Russia so they could buy Russian steel to make shells to shoot at Russians. No, we're not that stupid to sell them steel. But yeah, the fact that they actually proposed this. And the Americans, Russia was buying its cotton. Traditionally, Russia was growing their cotton in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, which is, by the way, why the Aral Sea dried up, though it's being refreshed now, replenished. And then there were other issues after the Soviet Union fell apart between different nationalities, like the Kazakhs, the Uzbeks trying to push the Kazakhs out of the Aral Sea zone, so they kept starving their water and things like that. But so Russia was buying all of this oil, I mean, I'm sorry, all of this cotton now from these former Soviet republics. So in 2017, the U.S. started pressuring them to stop selling cotton to Russia to starve it for gun cotton and manufacture shells. And Russians, being the white apes that they are, said, okay, let's think what else we can use. Oh, linen. Russian scientists worked out with linen, and Russia grows more linen, you know, flax, than anybody else in the world. So that's why Russia doesn't have any problems, never mind oil. It has plenty of gas and steel to make the shell and tungsten for that shell. But Russia also has plenty of linen and manufactures its own gun cotton, I guess gun linen now, in mass quantities. So no problems. Thank the Americans.
You have a very special, you have a very special way of destroying my Sundays, because if I thought I would never hear, if there was one thing I thought I would never hear, then it was like the word dual use cotton. It's just I didn't think that would ever enter my vocabulary, but thank you very much. Dual use cotton and dual use linen is now part of the vocabulary. So
We weaponized cotton.
you weaponized cotton. Wow. I mean, it's a low point of humanity. So long story short, I mean, you're saying like that one is not in short supply, and the industrial production of Russia is not in short supply. So what we are looking at is a what the NATO Ukrainian War Alliance managed to do is a short-term crunch. Although one must worry, like, what if they manage to destroy more refineries? And on the other hand, the Ukrainians need to worry, what if the Russians manage to destroy more of their production facilities? I mean, at which point is the entire energy infrastructure in Ukraine going to collapse? And at which point is the Russian energy supply going to be at that point? I mean, can you give us a feeling for where we are here?
Well, like I said, the Russian side is not the Russian side. The refineries are not destroyed. Some are damaged. Some are relatively lightly damaged, and they get them back up and running. I mean, they've been doing this at one degree or another for the last 3 years. They're just now hitting them deeper in. If you remember last summer, it was the same screams, the same thing, and they were hitting a lot. They were hitting a lot of refineries and storage facilities. They were just in Western Russia at that point. And at the end of the day, it didn't do anything. It caused some problems, and the problems were taken care of. Ukraine is a much more precarious situation because, A, Ukraine doesn't really produce any fuel. Ukraine gets its fuel from quite literally 20% of its diesel comes from Hungary. They cut that, and thank God for Ukraine's case in this case. They successfully basically were bombing the Druzhba pipeline, which should have honestly been shut down in this case, since it's counterfeiting the Ukrainian military. But because Orbán was Orbán, they want to keep him in good graces, that pipeline was still working. And Ukraine was, by the way, getting transition fees from the pipeline from Russia. This is a very odd conflict. So they're getting transport fees, and they're getting 20% of their diesel out of Hungary. Well, that's shut down, and on top of that, that fuel that the Europeans at the European Union is buying from India, it's now going back to Russia. So
Right.
that's lacking. So European Union in general, and Ukraine in particular, are going to have very big problems. And what Russia is doing now is behind that Donbass line that they've taken care of Kharkiv and Sumy Oblast, just blowing up all the 600 fueling stations. And Ukraine has about 12,000 overall through entire Ukraine. That's what I was told. That's about. I don't know how accurate that figure is. Now they're destroying in depth behind the line of contact. So the Ukrainians are going to have much more problems even trying to get fuel up there to their last fortified line, the Drzhovka, Konstantinovka, Slavinsk line. And the thing is, for those Ukrainian forces in there, getting out is already dangerous because it's open fields, but there's still greenery, some amount, and small groups could probably do it. But they would diddle too long, and if Rasputnitsa comes to visit, late September, early October, and all that turns to mud, they're not getting out. Whoever's in there is not getting. Plus, there's a Russian spike going up from Dobropolye, down there. There's two Dobropolyes, one's Zaporozhye, one down there. That's moving up behind the fortified line. So you got a pincer movement from both two sides going down from Krasny Liman and coming up from Konstantinovka. You got a frontal assault that's now about 5 kilometers outside of Kramatorsk and outside of Slavinsk. They've paused the frontal movement to take care of some encircled areas of Ukrainian soldiers and even out the front line. But it's still 5 kilometers out, 5, 6 kilometers out. And now you've got a spike that's starting to move its way up behind them. So it's a frontal assault, a pincer movement, and a double envelopment all in one.
Yes, it's absolutely horrible for the poor guys caught in there. But maybe a very last thing that I want to check with you before I let you go is, like, I've had on my channel recently Professor Vladimir Brovkin, and he was pitching an interesting interpretation of what is currently happening to Russia, and especially Russia's, you know, a lot of us are trying to make sense of why is Russia not reacting more forcefully? Why is it not, like, hitting Europe and whatnot? I mean, all of this is being planned over there and so on. And Porovkin actually was putting out the theory that overall Russia is learning how to deal with drones. It's like hide your strength, bide your time. So kind of, okay, let it happen, learn how to take out the drones, learn how to deal with this stuff that the Euro-NATO Atlantic Alliance can throw at you, and if push actually does come to shove, be at your fiercest and your most prepared. Do you think that there's anything behind that interpretation?
No, I mean, of course, Russia's learning how to destroy the drones. It's warfare is a constant offense defense movement, so it's a constant race. That's one, and Russia's playing that race just like everybody else. Two, of course, Russia is building up for the big war that apparently Europe really, 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 really wants. Look, Russia's manufacturing between 1,200 and 1,500 new tanks every single year for the last 3 years. T-90 Prorivs, with the latest models. They're upgrading old tanks also, like the T-72. They're changing the turret on them, and the Prorib itself is based. The T-90 is based off the T-72 model, just with upgraded different turret, upgraded, but the chassis is the same. So you don't see those tanks on a battlefield. Those are being prepared and put away and for the big fight. The question right now, quite literally, for any big fight, conventional fight, is how soon will the microwave radiation EMP the weapon systems show up on the battlefield?
You think they will
Chinese
drop
are
EMPs?
oh, af absolutely, absolutely. That's the only way to get rid of. Yeah, the problem with drones, you know, for example, lasers. Lasers are a great system against a drone. 5 kilometer range, half a second, it melts right through that plastic drone. Nothing you can do about it.
But
One
an
problem.
EMP is going to fry everything. If an EMP is
Yep,
going
yes,
to
it will.
fry a hard drive that's like not connected, that's not even like active, it's going to just fry
Yep.
everything. It's going to
Well,
be.
it fries in a directional area. And that's what you need. Because, you know, a laser could take out a drone. And if it takes 2 seconds for it to recharge and relocate to a different target, so you're servicing a single target. All these weapon systems service single targets. If you got 30, 40 drones in a very wide dispersal pattern coming in at that drone, I mean, at that laser station, it's done. You're never going to get them all. Because having to refocus, having to recharge, and you're servicing only one target at a time, those cheap drones are going to destroy a very expensive system. You need something that's area suppression. This is area suppression. Sure, yeah, everything that's electronic in that zone that's not armored up and protected. You know, if it's in a basement, it'll probably be okay. You can put lead lining. Problem is lead's heavy. And you can line the crap out of that drone, but then what do you do? That's a little problem right there. One of the more innovative methods of fighting drones that have come out recently is spray cans of paint.
What? Really?
Yeah, oh yeah, really. Easy. Drones coming at you, you start spraying in the air because, I mean, this is last line desperate, but it works. And then you get the hell out of the direction. One, it of course clogs, it covers up the camera because you get this aerosol. That's what I'm trying to say. You get this aerosol cloud. Two, the paint gets in the little motors and it clogs them up.
Or the quadcopters. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, for the quadcopters. So that can save somebody, but man, that's one, you got to have pretty good nerves. Two, you got to have the right air conditions. You know, it's not a wind that's just going to disperse it. And two, you're quite literally, this is last line of defense. That drone is 10 meters and closing, and you're kind of going, ah, shit. you pull out your can and you start spraying, and it's been used and it works, but this is not an optimal solution. Your optimal solution is take out the drone when it's about 3 kilometers from you, not 10 meters from you, or 3 meters from you. So that's, you need an area effect, and that's going to be the determining factor. When the drones become, drones are never going to go away, but the drones right now are the machine gun of 1914, 1915. Right.
So, long story short, we have the ground warfare, which is still like artillery base, but then we have the drone warfare, and right now it looks like the one side who's going to do a better job at innovating and intercepting is probably going to win that one.
Oh, of course. But then again, there's also production factors involved. And again, Russia can outproduce everybody.
Right.
Except maybe the Chinese. And once the front really starts moving, once you can break through, and Russia could. It could swallow the losses. The government hasn't made that decision yet. If you throw enough tanks and armor into the area, you'll break through, especially right now, considering how thin the Ukrainian lines are. Once the front is actually rolling, you'll see a lot fewer drones, because those drone operators have to get pretty pretty close up front when they're launching their drones. It's one thing when it's a pretty steady front. It's maybe moving 100 meters a day. Maybe not. Maybe, you know, it's a breakthrough. It's 200 meters in a day. It's a pretty steady front. It's a whole different thing if it's moving 10, 15 kilometers in a day. It's a lot harder to get out there carrying 10 drones on your back to try to launch these drones against tanks when the front's moving and there's enemy infantry and tanks all over the place. So that changes the mathematics quite a bit.
It does. It does.
But we'll see.
Drone warfare is also moving very, very quickly. And the scariest thing is, of course, the kind of AI innovation where you don't need an operator anymore. But I hate that kind of Skynet future that we're approaching. And before we go there, I want to wind down our discussion, because it is Sunday and you're supposed to go and have dinner, my friend. So people who want to find you, they should go to Mr. Slavic Man, Slavic with a K.
Slavic with all one word at YouTube. At Stanis Krepivnik, we couldn't fit the whole name in. Couldn't fit the whole name in when I was setting up for the X. And yes, by the way, if anybody asks, I did use a VPN to set up X. So they say, "Oh, it's an island. You're from Ireland." No, that's what the VPN was. It's a super technology called VPN, virtual private network.
It's nice to go to Ireland via VPN. It's even nicer to go and visit there and have a whiskey. But
I'd love to go to visit Ireland.
And I will put all of your social media into the description box below. People should go and find you there.
Yes.
Your show is always like gives a lot of insights and a lot of like on the ground information. So I recommend it to everybody. Anything to add?
Only one thing, and I'm sorry, this is going to be a downer. Think of everything that's happening on the battlefield right now, and that's all going to come home when this is over, because the genie right now is out of the box. There are systems made for defending point blank that are coming online, which are these masks that have radar systems and a light machine gun to take out drones if they're coming to a target. But this is something that, as a terrorist weapon, is a nightmare.
Yeah.
And it's not going to go away. So it's only going to, I mean, this is something any mob boss, any terrorist organization, you know, put up a drone, drop a grenade on somebody's car. This is something that we're all going to have to live with now. You know,
good,
it's one thing defending
West,
somebody's.
Good thing the West is not like propping up and supporting all of those NAZIs in Western Ukraine, right? Good thing that those people will never be the bad guys and would never ever have the idea of turning their attention to Poland and whatnot. Good thing, right?
And then we have Palantir that, you know, wants to do pre-crime. You've seen Minority Report?
I did.
They do. Yep. They want to do pre-crime. I don't think they have the psychics yet.
We have chat control now. So we're getting there in Europe. I mean, 2-3 more steps. Give it a couple of years, and we don't even need pre-crime. We just put everybody in prison by default, anyhow.
There are 3 people being sued right now. Well, I mean, sued. They're in court right now, and they're facing up to 5 years in jail in Germany for reposting articles from RT.
Right. And that is happening too. And we have Hüseyin Doğru, who's robbed of his livelihood, €500 a month for not committing a crime. never committed a crime, isn't punishable, just sanctioned because the foreign policy whiz don't like to see the legal behavior he does. So, and that's it. So,
and his mother is now sanctioned too.
Oh yeah,
his elderly mother.
The free world for you, everybody. The free world is as free as the people in Brussels decide and they want to have it. It's like you're free to do as they say. So that's the freedom of the European Union.
In the old days, if you were excommunicated from your village or your church, whatever, they really wanted you to leave. You're excommunicated. Go away. We don't want you here. No. You're excommunicated. We want you to stay here and starve to death in front of everybody so everybody can watch you. This is,
we have that in Europe. In Germany, you call it Vogelfrei. It's like, you're free to be killed. You're outside an outlaw, literal outlaw. You can be killed at any point in time, and it's fine. You can starve to death. It's okay. We are always coming back to good old ideas. Steph, you always...
Traditionalist.
You always manage to screw up my Sunday evenings. Thank you.
We should move this to Saturday, Sam. The Sunday, at least, recover mentally.
Everybody, go and subscribe to Stas Krapivnik. Stas, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.